If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Welcome back to Needle Exchange, celebrating the vibrant voices of embroidery and textile art. In this second part of my Needle Exchange, I'm with Irish stitcher Owen Kelly, and we dive into his dynamic present-day projects. From his ambitious quilt series, Where He Needs to Know How to Stop, to Seamus O'Commonsea, a hand-stitched travelling puppet that's connecting stitchers around the world. Seamus is awesome. I'm hoping I can get him on Needle Exchange at some point, but he is quite tricky. Apparently he's an excellent guest, if you can get him. Owen discusses the philosophy behind his improvisational flow stitching, the communal spirit of embroidery, and why embracing maximalism is his artistic superpower. If the story of Owen, and indeed Seamus, tickles your fancy, then check out my conversation with Sally Maver. That's episodes 67 and 68, whose playful work also unlocks new ways of looking at the work. Let's jump back in. If you're enjoying these stories, please consider leaving us a review on your favourite podcasting platform, as it helps new listeners find the vibrant world of Needle Exchange. Hope you enjoy this. Owen's a legend. I'll be back next week with somebody different. Enjoy the show. And you were stitching, so as a child or as a young man, you were just stitching for pleasure on the down low, kind of just doing it as a hobby in the same way as some people might do model making or, I don't know, sports or whatever. That was your...
I did sports as well. I was massively into sport. Yes. I think it was just something I did. It was just something I always did in private. Because I say I won't get into loads of details, but I had some very negative experiences over it. And so I did it undercover until I'd left home, and I was probably early 20s and I was sharing a house with someone and with this fella, 20 years older than me. And because we were sharing a sitting room, he saw me stitching and stuff. And he said that was the most incredible thing he'd ever seen. And this guy was worked as a bouncer for nightclubs. You know, he'd been in the army, boat builder. I don't know. Can you use the words? I would have described him in that era, that time, as a straight. You know, he was like an absolute straight guy. And I wasn't a straight. I was kind of like, weird. I'm not talking about sexuality.
It's not sexual
straight.
Thing. Yeah,
no,
yeah.
No. He's just a straight. Right. It was a straight. A working stiff. That kind of guy. Not massively well educated or experienced in life. He was a bouncer. He'd worked as also became my absolute best mate. But he was one of those people that go and when you haven't paid your car for your car and you go a repo man. He used to go and get
so
stuff.
Big boy then.
No. And ugly as hell. And I say, I would have been 20, he would have been in his 40s. And, but a man's man, you know, like I'm a man's man. And he saw my stuff and he just said, that's fucking amazing. So he kind of encouraged me to come out of my stitching closet, myself, imposed stitching. And then people started, like those bakers, people started saying, wow, would you do this and would you do that? And I remember doing a jacket for a woman that She taught me how to read, birth charts. Astrological, whatever. I was interested in it from the, because I'm very, still have a lot of interest in Greek history, Greek and Roman history, and a lot of the myths tied up with Venus and with Neptune, with the gods and all that kind of thing. So I thought it'd be interesting to learn how to draw a birth chart, and she was into that. So she taught me how to create these birth charts, and I use that imagery now. And I stitched hers on the back of a jacket. So I used her birth chart and then just embroidered it on the back of a jacket. And she absolutely loved it. And consequently, people saw it. So it became a sideline. I did jackets for people, whether I got paid for them or not. Sometimes I'd get a meal. Sometimes we'd go to a gig or whatever. Sometimes people just, if I didn't know them very well, they'd just give me some cash. So it was a sideline. It was, hobby. Well, I would almost think of it as a practice. It was just something you did, like you'd clean your teeth. I just stitched. Yeah. And I found very much a meditative process. It helped me it puts me in my happy zone. I love to stitch. So it's just something I'm in a position now, because the way my life is, that I can get up in the morning, come into my studio, start stitching. I do stop for cups of coffee now and again, and we have dinner sort of maybe 7 or 8 o'clock. But I can be sat here all day and every day,
right.
And absolutely love it. Yeah, the finishing side of it. I was going to say, we were talking earlier about I sometimes feel I don't see things the same way or view them from the same perspective. Even though I'm not, I'm not judging anybody, but I show a lot of my work on social media. That's my kind of main thing. I use Facebook groups and stuff, and I love getting feedback and I love getting comments. Some of them really make me laugh. You get these ones where I'm doing this quilt, 100 squares. I'm doing 100 squares, 4.5 by 3.5 inches. And they're all hand stitched, and I'm exploring different techniques and whatever, but I'm doing them very much in a flow stitch. I think one or two have been pre-designed. It was pre-designed because I did a collaboration with another artist. So I took their work and stitched it. So it's kind of pre-designed, but mostly it's not. And I post these things up. Let's say there's 100 panels. I'm up to about 80 at the moment. And I put them up, and I mention, I'm doing this, a quilt. And people's a very common reaction is, I can't wait until it's finished. People say, oh, I can't wait till this is finished. I couldn't wait till this. And I'm like, oh, God, I'm dreading finishing it, because I really love doing it. I love doing it.
Yeah.
And the idea that I'm then going to reach, originally I was going to do 80. I thought, 100 sounds better. I think 80 would have been easier.
We're going to have a word with you. We're going to be like, 144 is like a really great number. Owen, stop now.
Stop it. So I have a massive box. I have these plastic boxes full of these. And each panel has a story attached to it. I did a stint at an art college thing. And this one of the feedbacks I've got is when I was asked to display some of my work, and this is where this comment of less is more. Did you know the less is?
Okay.
I haven't worked out what the opposite of a minimalist is, but
maximalist.
I'm a maximalist. So if there's a spare space, I want to put something up. Oh, I want to put something in, or I want, I look at some, they curated my area for this exhibition really nicely. It was a college thing, and then the woman said, who was running it, like a fool, said, "Well, that's what I think, but you can add whatever you want." So everybody else in the class, I think, left theirs, and I just piled all my stuff out and was hanging it up. And she was like, "So you can't see everything. You can't see each individual thing now, because it's just full. There's too much." I'm like, yeah, I get that. But there's another bit thing I want to show you. There's another thing I want to do. There's this other bit that I want to show you. So yeah, an editor or a curator is probably what I need. I've never been able to edit, as you can tell from my conversation, or curate my stuff. I don't exhibit really, because it just. But this quilt, the idea was for this quilt is to have at least an exhibition piece that I could stick up. I think it'd be about 16 foot long and about 4.5 by 5 foot high.
Just a casual 16 foot. I think sometimes it sounds like you make symphonies. You don't make songs. You make things where there are so many pieces going on. But maybe yours are, and there's definitely like this left field thing, isn't there? Yours are like psychedelic symphonies where just everybody's playing all the instruments simultaneously and you just have to stand there and like let it wash over you.
A cacophony.
There we go.
A cacophony. I have used the word, I think it's a cornucopia of embroidery.
Nice. Like a dawn chorus at 4 o'clock like in the morning.
Oh, I love the dawn chorus. My studio here, I'm surrounded by trees. So in the morning, I open the door of the studio and I can just hear. This time of year is just superb. The bird song is amazing.
This is there's an app. Have you? Go on. Which one have you got?
Is it something like bird whatever? But you record the bird and you can find out what type of bird it is.
We use one called Merlin. And I listen out in the morning, and I listen to that birdsong, and then I look, and it's like three robins really just going at it, because they are the chorus or something.
Well, I heard something recently, and I don't know if it's true. My eldest brother is a bird nut. He works for the RSPCB and all that. He's big into it. But I just like looking at them. I have a bird feeder just outside, and another one stuck on the window. But I heard recently that great tits mimic other birds' alarm calls, so they will go near a bird feeder, say an alarm. Say there's a couple of greenfinches or a chaffinch. It'll do an alarm call for a chaffinch. The chaffinches all fly off, and it piles in and goes for the bird. If so, that's amazing. I love nature.
So there's this bird near us that makes a noise. It just kind of goes eek. And it keeps doing that all the time. It's driving my wife mad. And her brother uses a different app. And somebody else has gone, it's a great tit. But my wife's not having any of it. She refuses to believe that it's a great tit. Even though several people have gone, I think that's a great tit. But that might be what you're just saying there.
They are. Great tits are incredibly, incredibly loud. I had one the other day. Literally, I opened the door. And I was looking around. I was thinking, my God, it must be because it was so loud. And it was a... It was like an alarm call. It's such a little bird. Yeah,
same with wrens as well, isn't it? No, I will reel the birds back. But I mean, wrens make a lot of noise.
Yeah, but I think they're beautiful, beautiful singers. Which is one of the maddest ones is we have choughs here. Do you know choughs? They're like a crow, but they have red legs and they're insectivores. They have a curved beak. They're pretty rare, and we get the local parks people come down and they ring them and stuff. They keep an eye on them and things. Right. They sit on the roof of my shed out the back. And so when I take the dog, I studiously take the dog out for a stretch. And whenever we get there, there'll always be one or two on the roof. And it's they shake their like, so they're very unattractive noise, but I love. And then in the evening, they're incredible aerobats, whatever the air equivalent is. And they go and they're flying around, dive bombing each other. Fascinating birds to watch. Yeah.
When you see them, are you chuffed to bits? Yeah, I don't apologize for that joke at all.
You got one of them little drum sounds.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I think there's a website. Oh, God, what's it called? I'm sure there used to be a website called like sadtrombone.com. And when you went there was a button. When you pressed it, you just went.
my son is is a sound guy, you know. He's a sound guy. But no, that's what he does. He's he followed me sort of, well, I didn't follow me separately, into music. That's his, the production and sound effects. And he's got into the world. He loves the world of doing soundscapes. Have you ever come across soundscapes? I've not come across them until he had, till he but like, he'll do these tapes and you, and it's as though you're walking through a spaceship. He did one for me, like walking through a forest, and you can crunch and birds singing, and I absolutely love all those little sound effects. So sometimes when he comes down here with his, he's got a fluffy directional mic, and he's building up a like a library. I think it's going to be for like an academic, for a university sound library, so people can who are in drama groups or doing audio visual or whatever like that can access all these different sounds. But he was recording the chuffs for that I think for that purpose, so because they're not that common. We get ravens going across the top as well, these cawing of ravens when they fly over. I love that. Sound's very important.
Tell me about the Great Poobah.
The Grand Poobah, the Great Poobah. We officially, you see, I got asked by I came across on the, I say I'm in all these stitching groups, and I came across this woman, Anne Bowden, from she's from America, like this California-ish kind of area, I think. And she set up this Facebook group, World Peace, One World, One Stitch at a Time. It's one of these projects asking people to contribute. So I thought that was great. And I stitched, she wanted some leaves, and she wanted peace stitched in different languages. So I sent her one in Irish, and I just got involved. I like that kind of bringing people together. And I know there are lots of different projects. It just stood out for me. She seemed such a lovely go-getting lady. And she asked me at one stage, because at some when it's the project is complete, she would like it to tour around. And she said, I'm in Ireland. Would I help out, sort of thing? And I was like, I don't know a lot about that side of things, but I'd certainly contribute. And she said, oh, would you be, because I'm very active social media wise, would you be an ambassador? And I thought, oh, an ambassador. Well, that sounds rather good. I like that. And I was thinking of like little pyramids of Ferrero Rocher and all this stuff. And so I said, yeah, sure, I'd do it. And then she wrote me this lovely email confirming me as a stitching buddy. And I went, hold on, stitching buddy? Stitching buddy is a whole different concept to ambassador. Ambassador, I was thinking of a sash and maybe a tricorn hat and even a sword, you know. But stitching buddy, that sounds more like faded jeans and flip-flops.
You'd be lucky to get a Fry's Turkish Delight out of a stitching buddy, wouldn't you?
Yeah. So I said to her, look, yeah, I'll do, but no, you promised me a different title. And I do these posts, and I may have talked about it in one of my posts, saying I was disappointed that I'd gone from ambassador to stitching buddy. And lots of people piled in with some different comments. And I think I did have a word with Anne that, look, this is just for fun. You know, I wasn't actually offended. I was just teasing. And she got into the conversation, into the thread or whatever it is, and said, well, how terribly sorry she was. And, you know, and how about we settled with Poobah, a Grand Poobah? And I thought, wait, she may not have said Grand Poobah or Great Poobah, but I heard Great Poobah or Grand Poobah. And so I'm now the Grand Poobah. Now consequently, quite a lot of my work, I get involved in different, I have different personalities, different facets of the same diamond, of the same gem.
Yes.
So I kind of threw myself into the Grand Poobah, and I stitched myself a cowl with peace on it, written on it. And I had a hat. I made a hat for it. And I made the love glove.
I was going to say about the glove, right?
Oh, the love glove. So I made the love glove. And at the same time, it's just different elements. At the same time, there was quite a heated conversation about AI technology and stuff coming into craft. And it was just coming into craft at the time. And somebody had posted this thing, this AI abomination in one of my hand stitching groups. And I pointed out that it was an AI, and people were saying, what's AI, and blah, blah. And so I ended up stitching this glove, and then to keep it real, because the embroidery they'd shown was like of a skeleton, the bones and stuff like that, of an arm, I think it was. So I thought, well, I'm going to do this glove, and I'm going to do it in a kind of that kind of style, sort of AI-ish style with some bones in it, and I don't know, just whatever. And on the middle finger, the bird finger, I stitched real. On the knuckles, I had love, L-O-V-E, and on the thumb, I had G, so it was glove. So it was the love glove. And real was stitched on the middle finger. So if you gave someone the bird, I think that's what they euphemistically call it, it says real, you know. So I was trying to keep it real. Those are the grandpa boobos. So I did a little video, and of course, during that video, I displayed the properties of the glove and extended the finger. And but at the same time, I'd also written a post promoting the World Peace, One World, One Stitch at a Time project. So the two didn't really. So I re-edited it and took the finger out. So I didn't keep it real, which was a little disappointing. I was upset for a couple of weeks. But so one thing led to another, as in all good things.
Which then naturally follows on to, and so now we bring this to Seamus O'Comensy.
Well, Seamus is a wee man, so I think he is about 8 inches tall. And he is hand stitched in West Cork. He is a West Cork man, and he has a red hat, and he has rainbow embroidered trousers and this amazing like 70s shirt and a little blue waistcoat. And he came about because I woke up one morning and I said, oh, I've got this amazing idea. And turned to the missus and says, I've got an amazing idea. And got the usual, oh my God, response. What is it now? And I explained the concept. So the concept at the time was, I've developed this disability. So my movement is massively restricted. I love traveling, or used to love traveling all over the world. And I got lots of invites from people saying, would I come and see this? They're doing this. Would I come and see that? Within music, within embroidery, within, you know, I've got an exhibition, or would you like to come and stay? Or just very hospitable people. And I was having to say, in the last couple of years, this was just about pre-pandemic, I'm sorry, I can't, because I can't travel. And it was a little frustrating. So I thought what I might do is, if I stitch this doll — he doesn't like doll, puppet — if I send stitch this puppet and send him in my stead, and then people could take photographs of him and send the photographs to me, and I could see the world through Seamus's eyes. And I was kind of going to do this on my Facebook page, and I did it for a little while, couple of visits, and realized that actually this is taking up a whole huge space of my Facebook, losing continuity. So he now has his own Facebook page. So I keep everything over with Seamus.
Make sure we put that in the show notes.
Oh, please do. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a small thing. It's not for, it's for fun. I don't expect, it's not like roll up. This is a commercial, blah, blah project. It's not, it's just a bit of a laugh. And, I think I've got about 750 followers who come along for the ride.
And what does he play? Is it a mandolin, or is it a shillelagh, or
he didn't take that. That was when he was busking in Bantry, and he picked up those couple of girls. Yeah, that was a whole saga. Yeah, and Lolita came out of that actually. His girlfriend's been doing some modeling. I've got. She's just here, and she set up her own band. Actually, she's doing some great stuff. But what he's done is he goes and visits people. They take photographs. I put up the photographs. Seamus kind of says what's going on, which is instructed, I presume, by the people that are hosting him. So he's almost a bit like, I described it one time and felt that was a good description, like one of those tribal sticks, talking sticks, mm-hmm. you know, the talking yeah. sticks where you pass it to someone. So he's passed on to someone and they can have a conversation. So recently he was in Portugal and he went to stay with Elias, can't remember her surname, but she does, Relvas, Elias Relvas. And she makes these voodoo dolls, you know, these like little voodoo dolls and puts things like anxiety and they're like fridge magnets and you could stick pins in them. And mm-hmm. I got one with patriarchy I got from a daughter. There's some with Trump on that really wind people up but get some great comments. But he went to stay with her and meet the dolls and mm-hmm. get a little course of acupuncture while he was there. But she showed him around Lisbon. And brilliant. I think I've been to Lisbon, but I hadn't seen half that stuff, you know. And she took him to art galleries. He ended up having his photo taken in a meeting. Can't remember her name, but she was the Portuguese entry for the Eurovision Song Contest last year. Well, she like just met her in a pub doing a video. He went axe throwing. When he was in New Zealand, he did bungee jumping. Marika van Welken, I think it is, makes these incredible jackets, embroidered jackets. I'll send you a name because they're just fabulous jackets. You know, I think she's pretty well known. But he went to Holland and she was away doing an exhibition, but she arranged for him to have a little tour of all these different fabric artists in Holland, and then he ended up going to the European quilting exhibition, and he took her. And so, you know, I say she took him round. What she's doing is she takes him round, takes photographs of him, but with all the different quilts and meeting different. And
so, if other people want him to come and visit them, like they can just
there's a page on. I pinned it to the top of his Facebook page. I don't know whether anyone, when I first did it, lots of people, it's divided into Europe, Northern America, Australia, you know, and people, they put their name up or they DM him and just say, all right, we'd be interested. I mean, he's got a lot of people to visit. It was Zdenka at the moment in Slovakia, and he's right on the border of Ukraine and Hungary. And he spent Easter with them and discovered this, I'd never heard of this, but a Slovakian tradition where all the women get covered with water at Easter and beaten with willow sticks with ribbons on them. Sounds barbaric to me, but it's a cultural thing. So we experienced that and went to an egg museum, a decorated egg museum. So yeah, he goes all over the place. But the feedback I've had from some of his hosts, I remember this woman, he went into a special needs school and had an amazingly positive experience. He seems to be able to connect, or people could connect with this image, with this toy, with this character in a way that you probably couldn't connect with a human being. I don't, people let their guard down or something, but he's just very easy. You can stick him in his pocket, take him with you on your walk. And people have said to me that it's been great. It's like having a visitor, the Dagmar from Chechnya. She said to me that people would see her with this thing and would come up to her and go, what's that? And she ended up meeting people and having exchanges with people. And they were like, oh, yeah, it's just this mad thing from Ireland. You know, this mad fellow from Ireland. So this, I like to think there's humour, but it's also the idea really is in some ways is also promoting the community of stitching. So, so there's always an opportunity. What I like is if he visits somebody who's creative in any way, he went visited musicians, he's visit anybody, a cook, a chef, somebody who is creative, and they get to show their creativity through Seamus to a bunch of people who are interested in seeing different cultures and from different kind of nothing. It's nothing major, but a little bit of an antidote to normal social media, you know. Something yeah. just for a bit of fun. Yeah, I mean, someone could throw some politics in there if they want. And then next week he's going to be in Australia. Next week he's going to be somewhere else, you know.
It's a lovely way of reinforcing, like you say, the global community of needleworkers. And it was making me think of when I chatted with Sally Maver about the vignettes that she makes. And because a lot of her characters are dolls, they have this inherent innocence that people respond well to. They don't get very cynical about it. And so it sort of brings out that like joy to be found, in the same way as, I guess, if you like children and you see a four-year-old, you kind of want to show them the nice world, don't you? You kind of want to show them the best of it.
Yes, I think that's a very astute observation. I think it does, people, there is an innocence, and it allows you to be a little childlike. I mean, there was wonderful, this woman in, I think it was in Waterford or Wexford, and she sent me a photograph of her, and she had dressed as Seamus as well. I don't know if it was even intentional, but she had a red hat on. She looked like she was dressed up with Seamus, you know. And she again said she took him, I think she took him to this bookshop, and the next thing is I get a whole series of photographs of the owner of the bookshop with talking to Seamus and showing him the latest books in the red shop. Some things you just. And other people like some, and it's weird, everybody seems to respond differently. So I thought initially I'd get at least I asked for a minimum of a photo a day, and with maybe just a few words to tell me where it is or what it context. And then Seamus will make up stories, you know, he can do. Or if they want to write the story, they can write the story, you know. But if they're going to write the story, you need to write it in the first person rather than, we did this with Seamus. But I've had people making videos with him. I've had people, he was part of a puppet show, somewhere in Southbourne, I think in Holland. And he was on a podcast. He was been on the radio. He went on, do you know Stitchery Stories, Susan Weeks?
Yeah.
And he went to her place and was an assistant.
3-hour episode with her.
No, he was just assisting her with the editing and stuff. but she showed me all this yarn bombing around Hornsea that she is at.
Right.
But like, he went to see the Red Dress. You know, the Red Dress? Yeah, he went to see The Longest Yarn, that one with all the crochet of the Second World War. So he's got to places that I'm not able to get to. I miss that. I mean, I love being here, you know, and in my little bubble and stuff. But I am I live literally in the middle. Well, no, I live on the far. You've got to go through nowhere to get to where to get to me. So I'm on the furthest edge. So I don't interact with people a lot. So consequently, I talk too much when people do talk. But I socialize through predominantly my Facebook, but also through my Instagram and my Blue Sky. And I get to meet, is it virtual meet? Here, look, here's you and me talking away on a soggy Friday afternoon here. So, yeah.
Let's go and dive into the other questions. I feel like that's a good turning point. I do love the fact that Seamus is living the life that we all wish we could live. He's doing well. I love that he's on a podcast. That's so funny.
He's literally, I think his next stop is in Australia. With Jake Arnett, and who is Stitch Man,
right?
Oh, but who makes little dolls himself? So I'm really excited about seeing.
Is he a good house guest, or does he tend to like? Is does he like keep you up late at night telling stories?
I've been told he snores, and he has got soaked on more than one occasion. He finds his, he might have a little bit of a drinking problem because he's very absorbent. So he has ended up in a few people's pints. I know Paddy's Day, not this year, last year, Paddy's Day, I got a photograph of him lying on his back, knocking back a pint of Guinness. So he can be mischievous, but it's all generally in meant to be in good humor.
A grin on his face.
A trouble.
Twinkle in his eye.
Yeah, definitely a twinkle in his eye. Yeah.
Right, okay, so. We've already talked about the significance of Pink Floyd in your life. Mm. I feel like the question of do you have a favourite band is unanswerable, but we'll give it a whirl. Tell me about your music.
Yeah, well, music is a massive part, or has been, still is, a massive part of my life. I worked in the music industry off and on for maybe 20 years. On the A&R side of things, on the scouting side of things. So a lot of my friends are musicians and stuff. So music was a major, it's like periods, like favorite albums, favorite whatever, you know. What my favorite was when I was 15 is still one of my favorites because it'll never leave me. So what's my favorite now is But I was thinking about it because I knew this. You were going to ask this, and I think it's a really interesting question. So I settled on an album. Yeah.
Okay.
I wanted some honourable mentions, which was quite kind of difficult. And they're more about. I'm very interested in this in everything. I like a social connection. So I am attracted. Knowing musicians, I often am attracted to their music because there's a person. When a singer sits down in your front room and sings you a song, there is a connection, their newest song. Maybe they haven't played it to anyone before and they want you to hear it. I feel that is incredibly honored. I feel incredibly honored. Mm. And it is a real human contact of being there, being in the moment. Mm-hmm. So I might hear something on the radio or whatever and go, oh, I like that. But there is a personal connection. So I worked with this band that they didn't sign to our label or whatever like that, but I sort of A&R development and got to know this band. A guy is called The Picture House. Do you ever hear The Picture House? Probably not. No. In Ireland, they would have been pretty well known back in the 1990s. Now, I first came across them because they sent me a demo. So I listened to the demo and I absolutely loved the demo. Quite rocky, quite sort of slightly indie, but a bit of brassy rock. Yeah. And I thought, young lads, really interesting. So I went and saw them and developed a relationship with them. And then they got signed by another label and developed by another band, and they went into a different cycle. And the lead singer Dave, they got a new drummer. I think they changed the guitarist. Nick went, and they got this guy Duncan came in, and Duncan was from another band that a friend of mine had been working with, The Flood, and they came together and brought Dave. I think is one of the most fabulous voices in the Peter Gabriel kind of sphere, you know. His musical influences, he's a big fan of Billy Joel, and it slightly on the poppy side of things for me, but and then Duncan came in, who was into John Lennon and hits of the, you know, bands of the 60s, you know, the Pink Floyd, and more my kind of thing. He was from Sheffield, I believe, and he came in and the two of them combined together. And there was also a guy, Pete Glynnestu, who was the producer, who also had a lot of input. And they produced albums. I think it was on London. There was a whole saga. They toured with Meatloaf. They opened for Meatloaf. I remember going to see them. And they opened for Run Rig. Do you know Run Rig? I'm trying to think of the one big American rock band they toured with. But they were the kind of band, a bit like the old, a bit like Hawkwind, or a bit niche. You know, they had their following. They had a massive following, but they never really hit the commercial. They produced records, but they never got the major record company backing. They set up their own label. And in 1996, they produced an album called Shinebox. So that, I put that as my, because as an album. So I love, there's lots of individual songs on there. Fear of Flying, I almost have that as a mantra in my head sometimes, Fear of Flying. The fear, you know, experiencing the fear, you know, but then you do fly, you know, you'd have to listen to it. But I liked it. I'm very much into more into ethnic music and stuff, but that was the most commercial kind of album, I thought. So if I was to nail it down, because of the personal connection, because I love the people, and to throw into that, there is another person in my life called Big John Willie. I have a few of them, who is a kind of grand poobah. He's a bit like Super Dad Farty Pants. He's a bit more real than Seamus. But he plays music pretty badly. I posted some of his banjo solos online before now. He has his own Facebook page. And he, as a project, has been producing this album for a while, let's say. The producer is my son, who goes under the name, or doesn't now, but used to go under the name of Jiminy Junk, Jay Junk. He's on Spotify and stuff like that. He's a kind of more of a hip-hop sound artist kind of guy, but he agreed to do the production, and he was very good value for money. And because of my mobility issues, the songs are all written, you know, but because, and have been for years. But because of my mobility, I'm not really in a position to go into a studio and do recordings with him. So what has happened is... my son got the vocal down for me, and then that went out to different, so that's gone out, and that, Johnny Boyle has done the drumming. Johnny Boyle used to be, he drums with the Frames. They're an Irish band. I don't know if you come across the Frames. But he, you know, when he played with Marion Faithful and what, he's actually a professor of drumming at the, at BIM in Dublin. He's a drumming whore. He'll go for it. Anybody pay him, he'll go, and he's brilliant. And then another friend of mine, he got together with a friend of mine, Angus Ralston, who is now the bass player for the Waterboys. You know the Waterboys?
Okay.
Yeah. And they've put the drum and bass down. And Angus used to be in the Pitch House. Johnny bumped drums for the Pitch House. And I also, once that was done, I also sent one of the copies to Jeff Woods, who is now a music teacher in a school, but he used to be the keyboardist for the Pitch House. He's put some keys down on it. I've got friends, a friend of mine, Matt Moore, his son, sorry, is going to put some trad down for me. One of my daughters is an opera singer. She said she'll do some vocals. I have another daughter who is a concertina player. So all in all, this is not being released yet. Only a couple of tracks, Mushroom Moon, I think. But this is Big John Willie's greatest shits album. And at some stage, we hope to, and I stitched a hat for him. I don't know if I sent you a thing, but have you come across this hat?
Okay.
That's Big John Willie's hat. So
yeah, no, you have sent me a picture of that, right?
I stitched that for him. It's got all the elements going around it.
Presumably the album cover will be embroidered as well.
That's what I'm hoping. Yeah. Absolutely. And the t-shirts. And I've actually, you see the fabric of this hat I'm wearing here. This is what's taken from my embroidery. And I did a sweatshirt as well. I've been doing these multiple tiling the patterns and making fabric out of them. And this is from the quilt project. So one project links to another project, links to another project, links to another project.
Like a cacophony.
Like a cacophony, yeah. Or cornucopia. I wanted to shout out a girl called Ellen O'Mara. She's an Irish singer I came across, an Irish folk singer. Again, not anywhere. You'd find her on, I think you'd find her on Spotify. You'd find her on SoundCloud, Bandcamp, that kind of thing. But I absolutely adore her voice. I went to see, I don't go and see concerts anymore. Before, I used to see four or five concerts a week. I went to a gig in Lepp, Connolly's of Lepp, maybe 2 or 3 months ago, because I'd heard this, someone had sent me this, and I think she's got the voice of an angel. I absolutely adore her lyrics. It's almost like a, you know, being over dramatic, maybe, but she's like a Bob Dylan of her day. I just think the, she says that she thinks her work is quite, she's worried that it's depressing because it deals with issues, political issues, not being able to find places to live, of eating disorders, or, but I love listening to it. I don't hear any of that. I hear hope. I hear lyricism. I hear poetry, and dealing with such difficult issues in such a beautiful way. So I'm a big fan of her. And as I say, she's nowhere. She's not. She did a beautiful song about Palestine. And my latest music is I'm going to see, I booked in end of May, really excited, is Hun Hor Tu. Hun Hor Tu. Hunhurtu. Three words.
Okay.
And they are like Mongolian throat singing.
And okay. Sing, wah, 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 wah. All right.
And I absolutely, I look, there's a band called The Who, H-U. I don't know if you know that.
Right.
But they are like like Mongolian throat singing, that kind of area. It might not be specifically Mongolian. I think it is with The Who, but they combine that with like heavy rock, and it's just like mind. I find it mind blowing. I love that oriental string sound mixed with rock, mixed with the vibration of those voices, like Tibetan chanting or whatever. But
you would hope that The Who and The Who would get together at some point. That feels
you
nice,
would I, that's why I'm always, I don't know, I've never, is it The Who or The Who? I don't know. I'd not but they, it's HU, that's the heavy rock version of it. I love all that ethnic stuff.
When you're A&R-ing, is it like people send you demos and you listen out, and I don't know, like, you know magic when you hear it? Is that kind of how it works? Just listen and listen and listen to songs, and then, yeah, every now and again, like say when I've judged Anita Wert a prize, you can look at a lot of things, but you know magic when you see it.
Yeah, that's, it's really difficult because it's very much tuning in what it used to be. You see, now I've got friends who are now telling me that A&R's is a completely different world. It's all done now online. It's all done through apps that track views, you know. So there's no point, your record company's not going to be interested unless you're getting like 100,000 downloads. You know, it's not, there's no development. There's no, it's a completely different world. So, so back in my day, I was more of an A&R scout. So, so a job's worth body, really. So I had contacts in the UK, and I worked for a while with like a sub label, Compulsion, that was on Chrysalis before they sold and stuff. So the boss of that, Chris Briggs, would say, "Would you go?" He just wanted me to check out what was going on in Ireland. You know, at that time there was a lot going on. There'd been, you know, you had the U2s and this kind of thing, and so I basically, he wanted to keep abreast of what was going on. So he would, I would listen, get people to send me demos. I'd listen to hundreds of demos so he didn't have to listen. And I'd pick out the ones I thought he would like. So I'd pick, and not too many, because he was a busy man. So like, he had a particular, he was a guy that signed and developed Deacon Blue. So he had a kind of a feel in that, you know, whatever. He liked the Picture House, but we got outbid by London. But then I would go and see a band like, he would have hated the Cranberries. So I'd go and see the Cranberries and then my trigger, I'd go, well, Chris is not going to like this, but I know somebody who would. So I'd then say to Chris, do you mind if I send this on to somebody else? Mm. He'd be like, no. So my first line of duty was to the company. But then if they passed, I was pretty much free to tout to anybody else. So I would know people who were more into. I mean, we had these are bands you probably Songs of Ping.
Dancing at the disco, bumper to bumper.
There, where's me jump? Well, they were a kind of an indie stroke punk band sort of thing.
Yeah.
But like, I actually ended up unofficially putting together, bringing certain parties together, and they ended up signing to Rhythm King, but Rhythm King were a kind of like a dance label.
Right.
But Rhythm wanted to branch out. They wanted something that was credible, that was fun, that had commercial saleability. So I liked the Songs of Ping. I didn't necessarily think that Rhythm King would be a good fit, but they were sniffing about and they showed interest well before. But I just said, well, just supported both parties. So like when the band said to me, who the hell are these people? I mean, they're all right. You know, I know it's an odd way of doing it, blah, blah, blah. But they had a couple of good hits and I thought they were a great band, you know, and they weren't really, I'm not sure because I'm not involved in management or I don't know whether they would have got signed by EMI or Sony. They were more of an indie band and they were working and living out of Cork rather than London, you know?
Right.
So I would have thousands of stories about interactions with music and different bands and a huge privilege because there was really no other A&R men. I just fell into it over here because I'd been involved in music in the UK, moved to Ireland to tune in, turn on, drop out. And then I just started getting phone calls. Would you go see this? Would you go see that? Would you do me a favor? And I thought, well, I might as well go and see a few bands and get paid to do it at the same time. So, but there wasn't really anyone else.
When I launch my second podcast, Record Player Needle Exchange, that's when we can go down that route.
Yeah.
Do you have a favourite book?
Well, I thought that was an interesting question as well, because again, different periods. I don't read anymore. I listen to audiobooks, but I've pretty much given up reading because I spend most of my time stitching. But I love audiobooks. But
do you listen to those while you're stitching?
On occasion,
or do you just tend to listen
podcasts.
To music more? Right.
It depends. Again, you can go down that whole thing. I can get very easily influenced by what I am, my environment. Mm-hmm. So I would often, I do those quilt panels. And I would often, before I do a quilt panel, they only take me a day, 2 days to do, 3 days sometimes. And I would explore a genre of music. So I would put on, I did one the other day, as an artist called Mike Love, who is not the Beach Boys guy, Mike Love. He is a white Rastafarian from Hawaii. And
okay.
Absolutely adore. He does a lot of loop pedal stuff. Permanent Holiday. I think he is absolutely amazing. He would have possibly been, you know, he would be a choice as my favorite thing if I had more than one choice. Now I literally just I put him on shuffle, you know, on Spotify, and it's not surprising. I can see the influence of the Red, Yellow, and Green in the stitch work. I think there are a few hemp leaves tucked away there, designs, quite a bit of herringbone. You know, so I see that. There's another band called Seed. It was a German big brass, kind of reggae-ish, but it's more brassy, what do they call, dancehall sort of stuff, with a bit of rap. Very sort of urban, very brassy. So if I put that on, I will get a different patch. It will influence what I stitch, because I'm drawing on whatever is in my environment, in wherever I am at the moment. So music has a massive impact. I will sometimes to influence. If you see some of my patches and there's a Chinese influence, there's very strong possibility I was listening to some Chinese music at the time.
Yeah.
I did a South American influence one, and I was listening to all this amazing Bolivian guitar music while I was doing it. Puts me in the mood, puts me in the zone. But sometimes I'll on a bigger piece, like a jacket or something, I won't, because I'll be at it for three, four weeks. So I listen to podcasts and a lot of history, a lot of culture.
Do you have a favorite book?
Yes, in the sense of the Book of Kells. You know the Book of Kells?
No, go on.
The Book of Kells. It's a medieval illuminated manuscript. It's housed in Trinity College in Dublin. I think it's sort of 13th century, that kind of thing. You know, the illuminated texts and... Absolutely, mostly scriptures. I think it's in Latin, but all the designs of the illuminated scripts, the little animals, the trilliums, the different designs, Celtic knotwork, a lot of Celtic knotwork designs and stuff like that. So it is for me a visual feast. I have a whatever they call those copies, a facsimile. So visually and individually, there is only one Book of Kells. Do you know what I mean? It's handmade, it's handwritten, big, it's heavy, bound in leather, and beautifully illustrated. So favorite book, that particular book. Now, I presume the question was more about a book as in a published storybook.
No, I mean, it doesn't have to be. That's an easy win, that.
One of my favorite books is The Mabinogion.
Half of the things you've mentioned that then I have to write down phonetically. Now, go on.
Mabinogion. The Mabinogion.
Okay.
Which is it's like the Book of Taliesin. He's a bard. He's like a druidic bard and a soothsayer and storyteller. So Welsh mythologies and of stories of the gods, like over here we have the Dedannen and the stories of the fae and the people before, people like Breed and the gods and the goddesses and that kind of thing. I love that ancient. Yeah, I love that. It's our ancestral culture. So it's like I go to somewhere. I love being, would be a real hippie, but feeling the energy of the stones. You know, there's a pitched tomb here. And of course, you've got Newgrange up the country and the Hill of Tara, places. And I feel a connection, an ancestral connection. That's kind of like why I like all the folk, traditional folk. You know, like even from Persia or from North Africa, or I know people talk about cultural appropriation, and maybe I'm doing that, but I think we're all one culture, we're all one humanity. Mm. We're at a position where we jazz came out of two traditions. You know, I like the morphing and the changing, and we are evolving. I think it's important to acknowledge individual cultures. But I think we can also draw on them to the benefit of our artistic and our creative endeavors.
Yeah.
Not to get too deep.
No, love that. Do you have a favourite film? I feel like you probably haven't got any time. Spend too much time stitching, yeah.
Yeah, I'm really a big film watcher these days. I used to watch films, certainly when I was younger. Or also, author-wise, I wanted to mention Terry Pratchett, who said about books. Yeah. I adore Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman, Good Omens. Love that sort of stuff. And his brain was amazing. Got to meet him once.
Seamus has met him 5 times.
He was long gone before Seamus left. The most significant, the most significant film for me was probably The Blues Brothers.
Okay.
You know,
Blues Brothers.
I think that to me, I've had so many amazing experiences of that. I remember once going to see a midnight showing of it in a cinema in Bournemouth after the nightclubs had closed or something. They did a few of them. They did the Rocky Horror Show and a couple of others, but they did the Blues Brothers. And me and that friend of mine, I was telling you, Jim, the older fellow that lived with me, we dressed up as Jake and Elwood, but we were both pretty much Jake, because neither of them. we both liked our food. we had the glasses and the black hats, and that we had a little dance routine we did. So I loved that, and I loved the music. And it's a film I've been able to watch over and over again because I love all the music. I wouldn't normally watch films more than once. So I think that, and before that would have been probably the most cinematic impression I ever had was going to see Grease when I was a teenager, when it first came out. And I think that was the first and only time I've ever gone to see a film on subsequent days. I think I went and saw it 3 times on one day, then the next day, then really, and I knew all the lyrics. Really made a massive impact, possibly because I'd spent most of my life at boarding school. Films were not, you know, I would not be a big filmy person. I'm not really modern films. I wrote down a few others I really loved. High Society. High Society.
Woody Allen.
Fred Astaire.
Right.
Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Right. And all that one. musical. Grace Kelly, I think, was in that. So I loved that. All the Bud Abbott and Lou Costello movies. Bob Hope and Bing Crosby. Loved all those. Mm-hmm. But they're ones that have kind of stuck with me, but they aren't old
movies.
I loved all that. Didn't you have on Saturday? Was it Saturday? Saturday matinee or whatever? When I was a kid, the TV, so either on Sunday afternoon, just after lunch, or there was a black and white movie on my TV on one day, I loved dancing and music. So I think anything with Fred Astaire was a genius.
Yeah. I feel like it's weird. I feel like I've missed a trick. For some reason, I've always been a bit black and white movie averse for no particular reason other than maybe they just felt outdated. But, you know, when you think about all the bells and whistles people have got from making films now, the black and white film is not the ball out of the park because it was about acting. Yeah. That's pretty much all they had to rely on, wasn't it? Yeah. There's a lot. I need to again revisit them.
I love the music. I say I've always loved dancing. And I think Fred Astaire was just moved. Like, I just loved watching the way he moved. And probably Bob Hope and Big Crosby, maybe not the...
Charismatic, though.
But when Bing, loved his voice, loved that. And Bob Hope just made me laugh. He's just such a funny guy. Now,
I'm a bit nervous asking this next question, but it is a question I always ask. So is there a fact about Owen Kelly that not a lot of people know? Brace yourselves, everybody.
Well, it depends on what world we're talking about, you know, because within my stitching world, I don't know whether people know that I was an international table tennis coach.
Well, so that's interesting. Just for a second there, because back in the conversation earlier, you said about table tennis, and I wrote it down. So yeah, let's do table tennis.
Right. Well, the table tennis was a massive part of my life. I still am, even though I can't physically coach now. I'm a level 3 coach. I'd be like an international coach. I was head coach for the Irish team for the World Special Olympic Games. My son was number 1 in Ireland. One of my daughters was number 1 under 21 in Ireland. Yeah, I'm up to my gills. I was chairperson of the West Cork Table Tennis Association that I founded in 1987.
So did you get into that when you were a young person then?
My father was, he became a teacher. And when he was young, he got involved in table tennis. And he knew people like, again, this is a world I wouldn't expect, but he knew people like Johnny Leach and people who were way, Victor Barna, people back in the 50s who would be big names in table tennis, but probably not outside of table tennis. Mm-hmm. When he became a teacher, he was encouraged to have, at that time, teachers were encouraged to have another string to their bow, like an after school thing. So he went back to doing table tennis, and he kind of got me involved, and I would have been maybe about 6 or 7 years old. Mm. And so we would, I traveled all over the country playing in table tennis tournaments, played for the English schools at one stage. I was asked whether I was going to try out for Wales or for England. I had the opportunity for both. Ended up with going with England, so I only played once or twice. If I played for Wales, I'd probably have had a longer career as a junior. So yeah, no, I played at a significant level as a junior table tennis player, but more to the point was my coaching. I think that was where I wrote the Irish syllabus, educational syllabus, level 1s and level 2s. Up to my gills running. I at one stage I added up that I had coached over 5,000 kids in West Cork. I set up a club in the village. We had 12 tables at one stage, and we even had a former Chinese Olympic coach come over. And for a tiny little village like where I live, that was quite impressive.
Yeah. Is it? I mean, do you know you're good at table tennis when you're like standing 2 feet away from the table and still playing? That seems to be what makes a difference anytime I watch it online, is just they're nowhere near the table.
You don't need to be. I mean, one of the advantages of being stepping back from the table is that you get more time. So right. I think it was worked out. If table tennis table, like 9 foot long, 9 foot space between you, and you're hitting the ball near on just under 100 miles an hour, you've got like 0.06 of a second to react, which is quicker than blinking. You just blink. So it was quicker than that. So as an advantage to stepping back is that you have a little bit more time. I think most of your responses are instinctive, they're automated. So you train and train and train and train and train and train and train, and then you reproduce in it at the event. So you don't really, because I say about that much time, but you've also got to think what is on the ball, what direction is the ball going, what kind of spin is there, what's the speed of the ball, and where are you going to put it for the most of the optimum result. So you have to have an incredibly fast processing speed of your brain, or you are pre-programmed and you just respond. But if you respond the same way as every time, then your opponent's going to work out very quickly, tactically, how to beat you. Mm. So stepping back gives you a little bit more time, but it opens up the angle of the table.
Right. Yeah, it sounds to me like you know how the game is going to start, and you know how the game is going to finish, but how you get there is a bit like an improvised film, or a bit like the way you do your stitching a lot of the time. There's some weird similarities.
Possibly is. I mean, training-wise, you would train like third ball attack. So you would serve, you are in control of the ball, you serve in a certain way that you are trying to draw the opponent into putting the ball where you want the ball, and then you have trained how to respond to that. So right. You serve, the ball comes back, and you attack. So the vast right. majority of points are done within the third, fifth, and seventh ball. So right. you can have tactical approaches. If you are a player like a defensive player, then you rely upon going far beyond the seventh ball and having to get the other player. And you have different styles. You have people who are all-out attackers. You have defenders. You have counter-hitters. And people specialize in individual styles. There was one guy called Baldnut who had the big, also nicknamed the magician, because he had the ability to pretty much play any style he wanted. And he consequently ended up being probably the most famous world champion, Olympic champion in table tennis. But it is an absolute passion of mine that I've had since day one. But it is one of those things that you talk about with people and you kind of expect the eyes to slightly glaze.
If someone wants to get good at it, should they do that thing where you fold, like get a table, fold it up and play against yourself? Is that a good way to? Do you have to put in the reps?
If you're desperate. No, a good good training is more important than lots of training.
Right. The
hardest thing to do is to break habits. So that's mm-hmm. why it's so important, really, from a coaching point of view, is to get someone when they're young. If you are looking at elite level, if you're looking at right. just participation or recreational level, that's a different sport. I had a different approach to elite coaching, to participatory coaching. So the vast mm-hmm. majority of kids that I coached were interested in participating. They wanted just a fun experience from the sport mm-hmm. and would never go, probably only ever pick up a bat once or twice at a holiday resort after they'd left school. But if I could provide them with an interesting and educational and positive physical experience as a youngster, i.e. make it fun, through making it fun, also allow them to develop so they became aware that they were improving by doing mm-hmm. proficiency awards and things like that, then that's far more important. Elite coaching is a completely different ball game, pardon, and is a science, and is literally the 1%. But resource-wise, most sporting organizations puts all their money in the elite. Yeah. But actually, it's the participatory area so table tennis, I believe, is one of the most popular sports in the world. When you go to China, most popular indoor sport in the world, I think, other than maybe volleyball. But you go to China, and literally there are tables everywhere. You have halls, thousands of people coming in and just playing for fun. Generally, a quite high standard as well. But Mao was very keen. It was the national sport, and he was very keen on encouraging the population to become fit. And they had basically had a choice of Tai Chi or table tennis. So it became their national sport, and they are a large proportion of the population. So when you go there, you can see, instead of seeing a famous footballer selling advertising washing powder, you will see Marlin. You'll see massively significant people. Well, I was there. I was training with this woman. She was number one in the world at the time, and she had bodyguards and crowds of like 20 wow. deep outside yeah. the hall when she was training. They were heroes. So we have a different perspective on.
And she would stand 8 feet from the edge of the table.
Yeah, I mean, those. Things, I always think that going back when you're doing showcases, when you're trying to show off.
Yes.
You go back and you lob and you can get some absolutely wonderful at visual entertainment. Yeah. But it's not really something that happens. If you can, I watched the last Olympic final. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. There were probably, in the half an hour it took, 40 minutes it took, there were probably, I think there were three absolute moments of magic. You know, but like, you possibly would get that in a short match as well.
Yeah, that's amazing, that's amazing. Owen, thanks for having a needle exchange with me.
My pleasure, Jamie. Hopefully I didn't waffle on too long.
For joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's needle.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needle exchange. See you next time.